Okay, so you ready?
Marcel.
Yes.
Everything's good? Okay. All right, let's see what I can see if this works. Do we have a signal? Oh.
No.
Shit. Hold on. Let's see. Oh, that's much better, right? There's a kernel panic. All right. In any case. Okay. All right. So. So great. So this is a talk that I've now done a couple times. I did it as one of the keynote talks at OSCON, and I've at a couple other sort of conferences. But what I'm going to try to do is talk about free software and open source software, and sort of advocacy and activism. But I'm going to do it in sort of a strange way. Sort of when people talk about free software or open source, they're used to talking about doing advocacy for free software or for open source software. People talk about the way that it works, right? People say, it works better. You should use free software because it works better, or it's faster, or it works more efficiently, or it crashes less. I mean, this was like always the argument when I sort of came into this. It crashes less than Windows, which was like the major selling point because it had none of the features. 10 years ago, but I'm going to make a case for doing something very different, which is that making a case for free software or for open source, not by talking about the way that software works, but by talking about the way that software doesn't work, by the way that it fails. So here's sort of my overview. The first thing that I'm going to try to do is describe what I see as a problem in advocacy for free software and for open source software, and that problem is basically communicating our message to non-technical people, and this is something that I've sort of struggled with for a while. I'm going to argue that problem is largely connected to the fact that technology is invisible, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what I mean, and then I'm going to point to errors. Technological errors as an opportunity to reveal invisible technology, and through that process to reveal the power that technology has. And then what I hope to do for most of the time is actually just walk through a series of errors. I've been collecting these for about a year now, and I'll basically just point out a bunch of errors before which will hopefully be a little entertaining, and then come back and bring the argument back to free software and open source at the end. So. In any case, I'll lay out the problem to start. So this is the free software definition, which is of course not the problem. It's the solution, I suppose. But in any case, I don't know too much about this audience, but if it's the skill sharing audience, then perhaps you don't need to talk to you too much about what free software is or what it's about. But this is the sort of free software definition that people bandied around. It's sort of these four freedoms. I can now recite it in my sleep, and in fact do recite them in my sleep. Free software is the ability to use it for any purpose, study and modify it, distribute copies, and sort of collaborate and change. What's important about the free software definition, right, and these sort of ideas of freedom is that it's important to note in this context is that unlike, for example, Creative Commons or a bunch of other people that are working on free culture or sort of free software issues, the free software definition is focused entirely on users, right? This is all about freedom for the users of software. Now it's true that developers of software have the same freedoms that users do, insofar as developers of free software or open source software are users of software. But developers really, if they're going to sort of adhere to this definition, have less freedoms than sort of responsibilities. They have to, make sure that users have these things if they want to do free software. Free software developers in the free software movement, our sort of dark and I think very poorly kept secret is that we as a community have done a pretty rotten job of communicating our message to users, right? To non-technologists, to all the people who, in theory, we're trying to communicate to or bring freedom to. The vast majority of users don't understand free software, and they're certainly not participating in or advocating for software freedom. I'm on the board of directors of the Free Software Foundation, and so the Free Software Foundation has several thousand members. But I've met them at the members meeting, and they're definitely technologists. But if you look at other organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is not talking about free software, but is talking about power over technology, they don't. They're in the same situation. Open source initiative, same situation, often worse. And this is I think a little ironic because in the sort of sphere of free software, developers have everything to lose, right? We have our livelihoods, our comfortable business models, our nice lifestyles, etc., right? The users have everything to gain and developers have everything to lose, and yet developers are the only one who seem to get it. So they're sort of silent in debate. So this is a question that I, as someone who, for example, wants to raise the profile of, or I want to communicate this message as someone who's involved in this movement to users. It's something that I've been thinking about for a while. The first conclusion that I came to was that, again, maybe a little ironically, when we talk about free software, we talk a lot about software. We talk a lot about licenses, we talk a lot about source code, we talk a lot about the artifacts, right? The technology itself. When really, fundamentally, free software or open source is not really about software at all. It's about freedom, the critique, and so this is a critique of both, but you know, it's about power, right? Power over software, it's about control over software, and it's about autonomy. This is sort of the term that I've latched onto in the last year or so when trying to talk about sort of free software. And there's an example which I've been giving probably too often now. I've said it in quite a few places that explains a little bit about why I think that this is important. An example centers on communication technology, right? So let's say I want to call back to a good friend or a family member in the States, and I see a beautiful sunset here, and I want to communicate that to them. So hopefully this example will help illustrate this type of power and autonomy. So if I pick up my mobile phone, right, and I want to say, oh, I saw this beautiful sunset, I can describe it, you know, in words, but I can try to, you know, send a message that describes this beautiful sunset that I saw. But my message is going to be constrained by the technology that I'm using. So if I pick up a phone, I can describe it in words. I mean, I could even write a poetry, or I mean, I guess I could sing a song, right, about it. And I could convey some sort of message about that sunset. Now if my phone has a camera and the ability to send that picture, then the message is going to be very different. I'll be able to convey it, not necessarily better, maybe better, but differently. And if I'm limited to sending an SMS, then, you know, I've got 150 characters, the message is going to be constrained again. The point is that the designers or the technology that I'm using is constraining and framing and limiting the message that I can send. And all technology does this. It's not good, it's not bad, it's the nature of technology. But these technologies really quite explicitly sort of mitigate and mediate our lives and our experience. Insofar as our technology is important to our experience, it frames, you know, insofar as my ability to communicate is mediated by this technology, my phone or the technology that I'm using to communicate is determining quite explicitly what I can say, who I can say it to, how I can say it, when I can say it, right? It's putting real limits on my ability to communicate. And insofar as technology is increasingly important in our lives, our experience of the world, our experience is increasingly defined by the technology that we use, and by extension, by the technologists that control and write the technology that controls and writes our lives in a certain sense. But we, used broadly, we know that to a certain extent, even if we don't talk about it explicitly. As technologists or people who are more interested in technology or study technology, we know that technologist is powerful because we design and build technology, because we have that power as people who sort of take more control of their technology than others. And we understand the technology as a result. We understand that the question of who controls that technology is fundamentally important. We understand that the issue of who gets to define the way that technology works has a huge amount of power over its users. And that's ultimately the message behind free and open source software. And that ultimately is the sort of driving force, you know, the reason why organizations like the Free Software Foundation exist and are you know fighting for sort of software freedom. And it's certainly true, and I think that one very important reason that users don't support, you know, aren't as supportive or don't buy into the message behind free software is in large part because many users don't understand, you know, how or why or even that technology is powerful. But over time, I've come to the, you know, and I was happy with this answer for a couple of years and was involved in free software for a while. But over time, I sort of came to realize that for a lot of people, the problem was more fundamental. That it wasn't just that users of technology don't understand that technology is powerful. That in a large number of cases, users don't understand that technology exists. And that may sound like a strange thing to say, but I'll hopefully be able to show this in a little more depth. Let's see. Is that okay? Oh, okay, great. Where's my mouse here? That's, there we go. Okay. So let's see. Here's a quote from a guy named Mark Wiesner, who was the director of computer science at Xerox PARC for a while. He says, "A good tool is an invisible tool. By invisible, I mean that the tool does not intrude on your consciousness. You focus on the task, not the tool. Eyeglasses are a good tool. You look at the world, not the eyeglasses. The blind man tapping the cane feels the street, not the cane. Of course, tools are not invisible in themselves, but as a part of a context of use." Now, the next paragraph, he actually talks about how VI, the editor, is like a great example of one of these invisible tools. You hardly see it, which I thought was kind of funny. It's like exactly nobody agrees with you on this. But in any case, his point was that many technologies are really sort of invisible, and I think that I've certainly had this experience. I mean, I started out these conversations where people say, "Oh, what do you work on?" "Well, I work on this free software operating system called Debian, or later on called Ubuntu." Right? People say, "What's an operating system?" And it's like those conversations don't go well. If you first have to explain what an operating system is, then making the case that it should be free is going to be more difficult than if you don't. And in fact, I think a lot of technology exists this way. If I say it's important that we have control over our, you know, telecommunication systems or switches, or you should try OpenWRT, it's the software that runs on your, you know, router, people are like, "There's software on there?" It's hard to make an argument for free software if you have to make the argument for software. In particular cases, and I think that that's actually a huge problem for free software. You know, you can't talk about the power that a filtering system gives an internet service provider if people don't realize that their internet service providers are making real decisions about traffic shaping, about routers, about tools, about intermediaries, right? Unless you can't argue that users should have power over computing infrastructure if users don't understand that computing infrastructure exists. Now the good news is that although many users don't see it, technology is never perfect. The invisibility of technology is never perfect. Broken glasses, right, or even a smudge, right? If you have a little bit of a fingerprint on a pair of glasses, the glasses become pretty visible, right? Invisible technology, when it's not working, has the ability to become pretty visible indeed. In that way, sharks are kind of, arrows are kind of like the dorsal fin on the shark. You know, they're the bit. You may not see the whole technology, but when you see the fin on the shark, you understand that there's more there. They're the tip of the iceberg, and in that sense, they're also, I would argue, opportunities. They're and largely unexploited opportunities to sort of reveal technology around us, to discuss them, discuss the power that they have, and to sort of and to build on that as a way of talking about, you know, power and autonomy and control over technology. So what I'm sort of suggesting is a method of discussion, a method of conversation or evaluation, and to talk about sort of revealing errors. And I'm using that in there's two meanings in English, right? There's revealing errors both in terms of a process, something that we're doing. I am revealing errors, or we are revealing errors, but also errors that reveal something more about the technology itself and the power that they have. So That's sort of the idea of what I'm trying to do, and I think the best way to do that is to just jump into one example that is sort of the archetypical example of a revealing error. So this is an ATM with a blue screen of death. You've probably seen one. Here's another one. This one says this copy of Windows must be activated before you can log on. Do you want to activate Windows now? Nice of them to give the option. So I don't know if you guys seen any of these. No one?
Yes.
You have. Okay. I've seen a couple. And lots of other people have seen them as well. If you go on to Flickr, you can search for ATM blue screen of death, and you'll see, or ATM Windows, and you'll see like thousands of pictures of people who've taken them. And what's interesting is that these people are not, you know, these are not Windows haters. These are people these are normal people in most cases who see their bank machine in this sort of like state of, you know, insecurity and distress, and they want to take a picture. And the reason is many people will put them on their blogs if they have them or make comments. And so you can understand some of the thinking of people who are doing this. And it's exactly this process that I'm talking about. People see their ATM with the blue screen of death or something like this, and they say, my ATM, my bank runs Windows. You know, like, I'm trusting my money to Windows. And this is, you know, unlike, you know, free software people, these people run Windows at home. They've, in all likelihood, lost data to Windows. And this is one of these, holy shit, what if I lose the data that is my money to Windows, right? All of it, you know, the point is that it's not that, you know, this ATM was always running Windows, right? And every ATM was running an operating system. But nobody, maybe not even people like us, stopped to think, I wonder what operating system that ATM runs. It was just a machine that we take in a card, we press a couple buttons, and out comes money, right? But there's a whole set of technologies behind that. And the decisions for how to run the technology are important. They may, in fact, you know, have some bearing on our money in the long term. And those decisions are important, but those decisions were never important to the users of the technology because they never thought that they existed until the system didn't work, right? In that sense, it's sort of a process that encourages people to the crashed ATM or this error can start a process where people ask important questions of their technology and the technology sort of authors or designers, and brings up issues of control and power. I have one more in this class. This one says, "Welcome to the found new hardware wizard." The person who installed the card stealing hardware forgot to add the driver for it, or something like this. So, in any case, that's the basic idea. That's the basic idea behind revealing errors, is using these sorts of examples to start conversations about the way the technology works. And I think the best way to do it is just I'll step through a whole bunch of examples that I have here that are errors that show off something that I think is important about technology as a way of sort of showing the abilities that this method has. So, let's see. The first set of errors that I want to talk about are errors that reveal hidden constraints. So these are sort of every technology can work in certain ways. Every technology works in certain ways and doesn't work in other ways. And the result often is that we tend to for a communications technology makes it easier to communicate some messages than others. So here's an example. This is I don't know if anyone, I mean, this is a kind of, again, an English specific one, but I don't know if anyone recognizes these errors. I mean, meet of after dinner. This is a mistake using predictive text input on mobile phones. So T9, right, is the one by Tejik, which is now purchased by Nuance. But the idea is that you just press you press 7-3 and it will map it to me. But it has a database of words based on their frequency in the language that you're writing in, and then it will map it in that way. Now, it turns out that the word me and the word of are both 7-3. They're both pretty common words. Of, as it turns out, is slightly more common than me. Now, if I receive an SMS, or really any message that's been that makes that mistake, that mistakes me for of, then I know that it's been sent from, I mean, I can know that it's been sent from a, from a, a predictive text system, right? There's no way that a human using a QWERTY keyboard, for example, could mistake N-E for O-F. It's a type of error that's made possible by the technology, right? Similarly, this is, it's ponying at home is supposed to say it's snowing at home. I have no idea why ponying is more frequent, is listed as more frequent than snowing, but maybe. Apparently, in this particular database, it was. The idea is that the technology makes it easier to send these messages than others. The other thing is that if people are using a predictive text system, they're more likely to write full words, for example. If you're having to type, you know, the 333, you know, multiple times, then you want to become, it's easier to send these messages that use, you know, numbers instead of letters, that try to make abbreviations. If you're using a predictive text input, you're going to send different messages. All technology, all communication technology have affordances, right, and constraints. All technologies make it easier to send some messages than others. But when the technology screws up, we get a window into how that happens. Here's another nice one. Here we go. This says the within the GEITBG, the Cupertino with our Italian comrades proved to be very fruitful. It's kind of interesting. So Cupertino is, of course, the city where Apple is located. And it's not clear what the Cupertino with our Italian comrades would be. There's another one. And if you search for Cupertino, even in just UN documents, you get all kinds of references to this. What would the limits of this Cupertino be? So people were wondering. Some people found, you know, realized, well, Cupertino is in a bunch of places that it really shouldn't be. And there's no, I mean, it's not clear. I mean, it turns out that what it looks like when they're trying to write there is cooperation. And in fact, that's correct. It's supposed to say cooperation instead of Cupertino. But for some reason, on a whole thousands and thousands of documents, people have mistaken the word Cupertino, they use the term Cupertino, when they meant to use cooperation. So people were a little puzzled by this for a while, until someone eventually found a version of Microsoft Outlook Express 1996, that sure enough, if you spelled cooperation correctly, suggested, did you mean Cupertino? For some bizarre reason, they only had cooperation as a hyphenated word, even though that's not the most common spelling anymore, and their algorithm privileged words that were not hyphenated over words that were. So every time anyone spelled cooperation, it would suggest, do you mean Cupertino? And sometimes when people were just hitting apply, 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 sometimes they would type Cupertino instead. And so you see lots and lots of examples of this, right? The point is that in a way, because the default was change, this software made it easier to write Cupertino than to spell cooperation correctly. And as a result, some people, especially if they were pressed for time or moving quickly, ended up, you know, doing what was easier. Again, all technology has these affordances, right? They're not always quite as explicit or as obvious to people. But by looking at the errors, we can reveal these particular affordances, but also a whole family of other affordances that our software sort of has. And in the way they encourage us to ask sort of who, why, and how. Now, building on this, I think that this just reveals sort of affordances in technology. But you can take this a step further and look at affordances that reveal the values of the people that create it. Because these are just mistakes. Just someone screwed up and the technology did this. But there's a whole bunch of examples where those mistakes reveal, those constraints reveal the values of the person that created it. So here's a short video, which will hopefully... I have software updates. That revealed something. Here's one more. This one is just a very simple value. This one is an error that says error. Shitty IE needs this is undefined. So that's a value. We know this person doesn't like IE very much. Can I not? There we go.
Ah,
Nivian.
I think one thing that's helpful is the words we offer.
Have you indeed?
For example, if I type in I get ship. Nice, ship. Not a word people use, of course, ship. An improvised knife-like weapon, as in I dispatched the blackguard with my ship. Right, then the second choice of word is peaked. Oh, as in the abbreviation for the gene phosphatidylinositol glycan class T.
And those I believe are all the suggestions we offer. What about shit? It's a slang word for feces, and backstation anything or anyone of poor quality.
Yes, I know the term only too well.
Good, but are you seriously suggesting that the sort of people who compose predictive text messages on their mobile phones would ever use a word like shit? I was talking to the milkman this morning, and he said it's in quite common usage, so when someone types this, isn't it more likely they're trying to write shit than shiv or tigged? Our job, Gilbert, is to offer people not the words they do use, but the words that they should use.
So we always say.
Which is why when someone types in, we offer them curl or amble. Whereas we do not offer them cock. Or in. I believe predictive text can be a real force for good, turning rude messages into polite aversions, such as, sips off, you ducking yanker. We want to actually achieve nothing less than this. An entire generation of youngsters with manners, courtesy, and a weirdly extensive vocabulary. Oh, cloud could be landing.
There's a new world out there.
A new world in which people swear all the bloody time.
All the lonely time, you mean?
No, I don't. Just because you pretend they no longer exist, these new words won't just disappear. And besides, if someone really wants to write, let's say, bum jockey, stop switching to non-predictive mode and spelling it out letter by letter.
You're a talented boy, Gilbert, and I know you mean well, but sometimes you really are a total aunt.
So that's it. I like that video a lot. But I think that it's a great example of the way that the vowel using. So they build these word lists by taking large amounts of correctly spelled text or dictionaries and putting them into a system in the same way that spell checker dictionaries are built, right? You've got a list of words. And what's funny is that all of the dictionaries they build these from, and we know which dictionaries they build them from because it's public information, have the words shit and fuck and anal and cock. They remove these words from the list. I mean, and they are real words in English, and in every other language there are words that some people would rather we not have. But if you have a spell checker, right, who's ever tried to swear in a document and had the spell checker say, oh, did you spell this correctly? And you have to, I mean, it's a correctly spelled word. And yet the technology forces you to say, except I'm going to take personal responsibility for it, or even I'm such a bad person that I'm going to add it to my personal word list, you know, because I'm going to say this a lot, right? In a way, the technology, these are errors. They're correctly spelled words that are being pointed out as not real, but the technologies, but they've designed them so that it's easier to say nicer words than it is to say less nice words. And spell checkers make it easier to, you know, make people take personal responsibility. Because, you know, I mean, it's the values of the people that create this. It's not entirely clear, right? You know, I mean, maybe the predictive text message might accidentally show you shit when you didn't want it. But a spell checker, right? You're never going to see the word. It's only going to not correct a misspelled word. So in that sense, it shows an important set of values of the people who create your technology in a way that I think is actually pretty important. Now is the case of, you know, having to spell bum jockey letter by letter really a horrible thing? Probably not. But it helps show that the designers of our technology can and do have a set of values that they impose on the technology, which sort of frame our experience of the world. Now, in these cases, it might not be as bad. We know about it, and it becomes obvious. But in lots of other places, it doesn't. And lots of technologies have been designed by people with values to work in ways that we're not aware of. Because we may not even be aware of the technology itself, or the values of the people, or the effect that it's having in our lives. By looking at errors and the ways that the technologies don't work, we can start to have a more meaningful conversation about control over technology, both in these situations and more generally. So, let's see. Move over one here. So this is my other example of the shitty intermediary. So, you know, decoding values isn't always quite as difficult. The second sort of class of errors that I want to show is sort of hidden intermediaries. So this is the idea that, you know, when we communicate, when we're using technologies, often there are sort of men, or in most cases, you know, computers in the middle that are certainly reading our messages, but sometimes changing them in ways that we don't know. So all right, so this is, you know, a search for Apple on the Apple website, except it's not. I didn't actually type in Apple on the Apple website. I actually typed in AppleScript, and I tried to search for AppleScript on the Apple website. And Apple's website changed my search for AppleScript to a change for Apple. I don't know if someone here know why that might be.
It's AppleScripts.
What?
AppleScripts.
They removed the word script from the internet. So the result is that this has to do with something called cross-site scripting. The idea is that it turns out that many people...
They search just for the first word.
What?
No, perhaps they search just the first word.
No, it was one word. I typed in AppleScript, one word.
Huh.
So obviously, if I want information about AppleScript, searching for Apple on the Apple website is not a very good way to do it, because every page on the Apple website has Apple in it, right? Which is why there are 33,000 hits. It turns out that there's a basically a security vulnerability in many different websites, that when users can type in data that's displayed to other users, one of the things they can do is they can embed code, which can then compromise the security of users that come and view that page later. So if I can write a message on a forum, I can write in a little program which will then run on the computer of everyone who views that web page later. So the way that you do that is you basically write a little script tag, and it says open bracket script close bracket my code open bracket slash script, etc. And so one way to stop cross-site scripting is to remove every instance of those script tags, because if there's no script tags, then the users who come later, their web browsers won't run the program. Now this one, they got a little Apple got a little overexcited when they wrote this version, and they just actually removed all instances of the word script from all input on their website, which meant that anytime anyone went to the Apple website trying to search for entering in the word script anywhere, like for example in the name of their product, AppleScript, it removed the word script, and users didn't get something that they wanted. Now most users saw this, say, oh, well, that's really useful. What's going on? People are very confused. Why does it, every time I type AppleScript, it changes it to Apple? But the point is that it starts a process that, when you can explain this to people, it helps people realize that, in fact, there's actually a bunch of software which is reading, there's software that exists on Apple's website, which is reading every message that comes in, which is changing every message that comes in certain ways. And yes, they're obviously removing the word script, but they're probably doing other things as well. These intermediaries are all around us. They're changing the messages that we use to communicate, and yet we don't know about them in most cases. Errors are one way that we can reveal those intermediaries. Here's another example, hopefully. Yes. This is a headline from there's a website called onenewsnow.com, which is run by basically a right-wing Christian organization in the U.S. called the American Family Association, and they run one of the things that One News Now does is they run a news feed where they take stories published by the Associated Press and then they republish them on their website. And they pick certain stories. Now, one thing that's kind of funny about this, this is a strange article. It says, homosexual eases into the 100 final at the Olympic trials. He said, that seems like a weird thing to write. But if you look a little more closely, it says, Tyson homosexual easily won the semifinal. So the man's name is not Tyson homosexual. The man's name is Tyson gay. And you know, he happens to have the last name gay. Now what's interesting is that One News Now, as a sort of Christian organization, thinks that people should use the word homosexual instead of gay, because homosexual sounds almost clinical, like more pathological. It's a problem, you know. Gay sounds like, I mean, almost happy. You might want to be gay, right? But who would want to be homosexual, right? So one of the things they do is they go through every article that comes in on their site, and they change every instance of the word gay to homosexual. And you know, that's not the only thing. I mean, so this is obviously not the only article. If you look, homosexuals, actually, there's a whole set of papers on homosexuals winning running trials. Tyson Gay is a very
He's a great sprinter. So there's all kinds of, you know, all these things. Homosexual barely averts major flop in 100. All these sorts of things. So now
the point, the nice thing about this is both that it reveals a hidden intermediary, right? In that One News Now had been running this website for a year and a half. They'd been making this change and a whole series of other changes. They changed words that they don't like to ones that they didn't. But what's interesting is that no one knew they were doing it. The readers on their site, now of course the readers on their site, because they're at, you know, a site run by this right-wing organization, are perhaps likely to agree with this. But most users of the site never knew that their messages were being changed. And it's certainly the case that the AP, the Associated Press, didn't know that their messages were being changed. Now, for a year and a half, no one noticed. And the reason no one noticed was because in the vast majority of situations, it worked. When the system was working correctly, no one realized that there was someone changing the messages in ways that really did convey something very different in some cases. Only when the system didn't work did people see it. And then everyone saw it, right? Because it got on all these blogs, and people thought it was very funny that they were talking about homosexuals winning these sorts of things. It was a funny sort of error. But it shows both, in that sense, it reveals both the values of the people that create it. We now know some things about the organization, about this organization, who thinks that terminology is very important in certain ways. And we've learned something about the existence of the hidden intermediary. So I'd say that's a nice example of something that shows off a few things. Now, of course, our technology and our communication is always sort of mediated, right? All the messages we're putting out is mediated. We just don't know why. We don't know how. And in most cases, as a result, we don't reflect on the way that on the power that's given to the mediators. Errors are one way that that we can get a window into exactly how those things are being changed and start a conversation about how the technology is powerful. So, let's see. I think this is the final set of errors that I want to show are errors that provide views into closed systems. So computer scientists talk a lot about abstraction, right? In fact, if you're in a computer science course, basically the first week you learn syntax, and the next day you learn, and the next week you learn abstraction, and then you learn abstraction until you've got your PhD, in which case you teach abstraction. I mean, computer science is all about taking complexity and sort of hiding it, good computer science. And you know, this idea of a black box, which quite a number of people have talked about, is something that's important. Now, one thing that's nice about errors is they often can sort of give us a window into those black boxes. So this is Google's calculate function, calculator function, and one of the things it can do is it can change between lots of different units. So Google, when they launched this tool, said, this is actually working correctly, but when they launched this tool initially, I said, wow, that looks a lot like this software, free software called GNU Units. A lot of people used it, but it does exactly this. GNU Units, you say, convert from one set of units into another. I want, you know, kilometers to miles or something like this. Or you can do, so I said, you know what? There was a couple bugs in GNU Units that always annoyed me. And in particular, there was one related to exactly this, to converting from degrees of Celsius to degrees in Fahrenheit. And the bug was basically the units would not convert between. If you said it's, you know, 10 degrees outside, how hot is that in Fahrenheit? Units would never give you the correct answer. What units would do is it would convert between. If the temperature went up 10 degrees Celsius, how many degrees up would it have gone in Fahrenheit? And so the difference is, because they start at different zero points, they would give different answers in most cases. In any case, this bug had annoyed me for like years in units. And I said, I wonder if Google has the same thing. Sure enough, they did. I went and I looked at other bugs that were open against GNU Units. All the bugs showed up in Google Calculator as well. So, I mean, it's certainly possible that Google just implemented it accidentally, exactly the same way that GNU Units is. But that doesn't actually sound most that likely. I mean, in all likelihood, Google took the source code for GNU Units. Now, GNU Units is under the GPL, so they have to give the source code to anyone they give the software to. But because Google runs a network service, they don't give the software to anybody. So they don't have to share. And in fact, they have not shared. All of the bugs that I mentioned still exist in GNU Units. Google has since fixed it in all of these cases. But more importantly, but But by seeing one error, I understood all, by seeing one error in their system, and in particular by being able to map that error to a particular known piece of technology, you know, users were able to know exactly what was going on in there, right? Because we knew what we had copies of the source code externally, right? One little error was able to reveal quite a bit about what was going on. Sometimes the same sort of process is very explicit. Here's an ATM, and it says this is a trace pack, and it actually has the code, the source code right here. It was in this line, you know. So you're like, oh wow. You know. Sometimes you actually get to see a picture of the source code, and very often when these sort of black boxes are broken open, we can learn quite a lot about the way the software works. Now, in this case, it wasn't exactly that sort of thing. My favorite and my final example of this has to do with Facebook. So one time I was looking on the Facebook. Facebook has a website like opensource.facebook where they give away a bunch of patches to pieces of free software, open source software. And they give away a lot of Apache plugins. And I was there and I saw one that said source protector plugin or source protector patch for Apache. So that's strange. I wonder what they're worried about. And I looked at it and it was like, this code lets Apache users be sure that they're not accidentally distributing source code to their application. It's kind of strange. I wonder, has Facebook accidentally distributed source code to their application? The answer is yes, twice. On two separate occasions, Facebook has accidentally had errors in their system, which accidentally basically presented users with all of the source code to their application. And the reason that's important is because users, when they saw into that system because of that error, actually learned some things that Facebook would rather them not know. Here's two pieces from the Facebook source code that was accidentally revealed through an error.
The first one is an array which contains two numbers, which, if you know Facebook, look a lot like a user identification numbers, and just say user IDs. And then there's a little comment that says, put baddies, hotties, in here. Like the, here's a way that we can monitor, that's the name of the variable, people that we think are bad or attractive. Here's an even more shocking comment, which says, monitor these people's profile viewage, stored in the central database on profile views, helpful for law enforcement to monitor stalkers and stalkies. Right? The important thing to notice is that Facebook, you know, the designer of any application that you use has power to do these sorts of things, right? But when we don't have access to knowledge of what's going on in the software, we don't know. Now, Facebook had been doing this for years. They've since installed their source protection plugin, which is going to make it much less likely that we have similar views, but using their code. But for all we know, we have no reason to believe they've stopped doing this, and every reason to believe they're doing it more. It had always been working like this, and I think that this sort of information is of interest to many users of a system. Maybe people aren't going to stop using Facebook, right? But it's nice to know that you're being monitored, or the people whose website you're using are working with law enforcement to sort of keep you honest. But the point is that while they were always sort of doing this, people didn't know because the technology just worked, and because these sorts of actions behind the scenes were invisible. It's only when the software doesn't work that we get to see. See things quite visibly. I'll give one more example. I had a friend who wrote a piece of software for basically music sharing, and lots of people would use it, and it would have a list of users who were logged onto the site. And he broke up with his girlfriend, and then had got a new girlfriend, and they both used the site. And his old girlfriend was like, every time I use the site, if I see your new girlfriend's name on the side, on the list of people who are logged in, I always get upset. So he wrote a little patch to the software that would, if you were the old girlfriend, it would hide the new girlfriend's name. It was a cute little piece of software. Unfortunately, he made a syntax error when he wrote it, put it into the live version of the site, and every user of the site for several hours, which was quite a few people, saw the traceback and the error of exactly the line of the if your name is the new girlfriend or old girlfriend, hide the name of the old girlfriend. So another example of a way that this nice little black box, if you don't know what's going on, you know, it can maybe make a nice experience. In that case, maybe it wasn't as horrible thing to do, or it wasn't as potentially problematic for any of the people, but there were a few people who were like, more information than I needed, man. More information than I needed. So the point is, this sort of thing happens in all software that we write. So that's what I have in terms of errors. I can just sort of I'll just sort of wrap up by saying that, you know, technology is going to happen. Our lives are going to become increasingly sort of mediated by technology. Our only real choice is how, right? Is it going to be software that we can control, or is it going to be software that other people are going to control? Is it going to be laptops or mobile phones? Is it going to be technology that we have written or can write or can modify or can understand? Or is there going to be software written by the people of those, you know, the people that made those very well-functioning bankomats I showed earlier? I hope I've shown that there is a power in politics to technology design, right? And that as technologists are in some way the politicians. And I think that what that means is that we have a responsibility to communicate and teach about technology to others and to democratize technological understanding, and that we must, can, and should build, you know, better, more free, and a more open world, and that errors can be one part of helping spread that message to the people who really matter, who is, you know, everyone else who uses this stuff. So with that said, I just have three sort of personal suggestions. Let's see. Oops. The first is to sort of pay attention to errors where you see them, right? Think about what they reveal when you see a technology that's in its sort of sad state. And think about the power and politics of that technology and what it might reveal. Think about the impact of closed and controlled code. And think about closed and controlled code when you see it. The second thing is to teach people about technology wherever possible. I think that technology education, in a sense, is actually the most, I mean, one of the most important sort of, maybe it's always one of the most important issues, but I think that it's information technology and technology education is going to be hugely important. And then, and I think that it's a really important project that we need to think about doing in more creative ways and need to do in a whole bunch of different situations. And then finally, and selfishly, when you see great errors, you should go to revealingerrors.com, or you should send me an email and say, I took a picture of this great thing, you should do it, check it out. And I'm collecting as many of these as I can. I've been doing it for about a year now, and I'll probably do it for about another year at least, with the idea of putting together a wide collection of some great, hopefully entertaining errors, with the idea that I can write these things up into a book aimed not at technologists, but at, you know, normal people who like reading about broken technology, which apparently is quite a lot of people. People like other people's misfortune, find it entertaining. So please help add to my collection by sending emails. So thanks everyone for showing up. I appreciate it, and I hope that you have enjoyed some of these errors and find some of your own. Thanks. I don't know if people have questions or, yeah. You have some? You have pictures?
Yeah.
Cool, send me emails, yeah. Oh yeah, the train stations. Yeah, yeah, there's like it's funny when you see like old operating systems that you probably no longer use. I see these like OS2 crashed OS2 machines all over.
He was constantly rebooting, looking for the terminal server where to boot.
Yep. So send the email. I love them. They're great. And you can check out the blog. I post a new error every week or so. With an explanation of what it reveals. So, the other questions or wanna? Okay, cool. Well, I'll hang around if you want to talk. So, cool. Thanks for coming, everyone.